Thank you, David. Very, very happy to be here. And I want to thank the organizers for organizing such a great thing, such a great program. So today I'm going to talk about some work done in collaboration with Domenico Orlando, Susanna Reffert, on the string theory of the Omega Deformation. Okay. It's based on a recent paper from June 2011 and some background work in previous work by Reffert and Orlando. So. Okay, fine. Don't worry. Today, yeah, I'm going to be talking about that and open it with this thing, which is better at full screen. There we go. There we go. Yeah. Right. So I'm going to be talking about some work done with Domenico Orlando and Susanna Reffert on the string theory construction of the gauge theory beta ansatz correspondence of Nekrasov and Shadashvili. Yes. So, what is that thing all about? Thank you, Domenico. Just send me a PDF, please. It is a correspondence on the one hand between the vacuum states of a set of gauge theories, and on the other hand the full Hilbert space of a, well, okay, thank you. The full Hilbert space of a single spin chain. Yeah. So, the full Hilbert, yes, thank you. Very good, thank you. The full Hilbert space of a single spin chain, the full Hilbert space of a single spin chain. Right. In its simplest manifestation, the ground state of a supersymmetric gauge theory, or a set of supersymmetric gauge theories on the one hand, and the spectrum in the vacuum sector of a spin chain. Okay. There are years of experience in the study of both sides of the correspondence. So a set of two-dimensional gauge theories that have been very well studied. We can translate problems from one side to the other. We have fresh perspective on existing problems, and some new natural questions arise as well. So in particular, I'd like to understand this correspondence in the context of string theory. And I'm going to describe a D-brain construction of the gauge theories we're talking about. I won't have too much to say about the spin chain, but I will hopefully be able to describe enough about it to explain why there are interesting questions that can be fruitfully addressed with this spin chain language. We're going to construct the gauge theory in the way that we often do in string theory, in terms of a brain construction. Okay, so we'll set up a configuration of D brains and NS brains, which reproduce all of the structure of the gauge theory with the exception of a particular term, which is a completely consistent and interesting term, but not a quote-unquote standard thing. So something that is not a standard ingredient of brain constructions. We will explain how to deform the brain construction by this non-standard ingredient called a twisted mass term for the adjoint chiral multiplets. So we'll construct that in terms of a deformation of the closed string background, not of the brain configuration itself, but of the gravity and dilaton and flux solution describing the background, which would otherwise be flat space. So let me give a little bit of the background. So the gauge beta correspondence relates the vacuum sector of a set of supersymmetric gauge theories to the states of a single spin chain and to each other. So spin chains have symmetries that relate different sectors. So we have, in the simplest case, we have a set of spins, L spins, periodically identified with coupling terms. And there are symmetries, for instance, the spin flip symmetry. Right, so we look at a case where there's no magnetic field present, and we get the exact same Hamiltonian with all spins up as we do for all spins down. Okay, but there are larger symmetries, non-abelian symmetries, in the absence of an external magnetic field, which you can see from the fact that a spin can be thought of as a two-site spin system can be thought of as the fundamental representation of SU2. So in particular, there is an SU2 global symmetry acting on this spin chain. And in fact, there's a much larger symmetry that renders the spin system integrable for the simplest spin system, such as the XXX model. But I'm not actually going to talk about this larger symmetry, except maybe as a way of motivating some questions for further study. So the Nekrasov-Shadashvili correspondence is a correspondence between, on the one hand, two-dimensional gauge theories, and on the other hand, this type of spin system. So the main question I want to try to address today is, how does one see this enhanced global symmetry in the gauge theory? Okay. So this enhanced the global symmetry, the SU2, for instance, is just manifestly visible in the spin chain, and not at all visible in any simple to understand way in the two-dimensional gauge theory. However, we will see that in string theory, in the simplest string theory embedding of this gauge theory, the SU2 symmetry or higher non-abelian symmetry will be manifest. Okay, so that is the motivation for embedding in string theory. But then we'll see that in order to do that, we're going to have to get around this technical issue of the twisted mass deformation. Okay. So questions about the setup. Well, okay, so there are a number of levels on which one can study this. But so the simplest context is two-dimensional gauge theories that are related to those four-dimensional theories by bidimensional reduction. The dimension, not quite the same dimensional reduction I'm going to mention later on, but yeah, so the lift to four dimensions gets into a lot of other interesting territory, which maybe at the end I can address. But more likely, Susanna and Domenico will talk about in part two, which will come next week. So let me talk about the two-dimensional field theories and how you think about them, how you think about the twisted mass deformation, and where these spin systems come in. So we're looking at field theories with 2,2 supersymmetry in two dimensions or more, so two left and two right moving supercharges. And they are based on gauge multiplets coupled to chiral superfields in some representation of the gauge symmetry. So a chiral superfield is something that is annihilated by the left and right moving barred superderivatives. And it has a theta expansion, which contains a complex boson, a complex fermion, and an auxiliary field. And then a twisted chiral superfield is the same thing, but with an exchange of the right moving D and the right moving D bar. So for people who like to think about mirror symmetry, it's the mirror of a chiral multiplet. Now, in particular, any theory which has a gauge multiplet that can couple to chiral superfields automatically contains one twisted chiral multiplet, which it comes from the field strength of the gauge multiplet. Okay. So in particular, you can't get just a gauge connection in two dimensions with 2, 2 or more supersymmetry. It always contains a complex scalar sigma, which is the lowest component of a twisted chiral multiplet, as well as some gluinos and a complex auxiliary field containing this, the real field D and the real field strength. So A01 is the curvature of the gauge connection. This is the field content of the 2, 2 gauge multiplet. And this complex scalar sigma has some interesting quantum dynamics, which describes an intricate vacuum structure in just some rather ordinary looking two-dimensional gauge theories. So the kinetic term for the Lagrangian is just the minimal coupling to the chiral multiplets X, as well as a kinetic term for the gauge multiplet. That's that second term involving the sigmas. Okay. So now what's the other stuff that we add? So this Lagrangian L twisted, now you look at this, it doesn't look very supersymmetric, right? It has some explicit thetas in the Lagrangian. So superspace and supersymmetry people must realize that the general construction of supersymmetric perturbations of the Lagrangian just comes from taking superfields, basically any superfield, and any composite function you can write out of superfields and their covariant derivatives, and integrating it all over the full superspace. Right? That automatically gives you a supersymmetric term. However, if you have explicit functions of the superspace variables, it does not automatically give you a supersymmetric term. In fact, it never gives you a supersymmetric term under the original supersymmetry. So the question is, what is this term called the twisted mass term? Why is it allowed, even though it doesn't look supersymmetric? So the answer is that it's not supersymmetric unless you deform the Suzy algebra itself. And I will talk about that and actually use it to construct our string theory embedding in a little while. But for the moment, just trust me that this twisted mass term gives a mass equal to tilde m to the field X.
Okay.
Oh, we can also add a superpotential. I didn't, but you can. Sorry. Ah. I say you can. Right, so sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. So one of the things I will talk about, if this is the most, is this is based on the most recent version I sent, or will I have to switch over midstream? Huh? I can't remember which one that is. Okay, but at any rate, I will talk about it. And maybe I'll have to switch the little plug thingy at some point, so sorry. Now, there are also Fayet-Eliopoulos terms. I'm not going to talk too much about them because in the end, the interesting thing to do is to set those to zero. But the effect of the Fayet-Eliopoulos terms and the twisted mass term and so forth is to, in some sense, to regulate the theory in the infrared, to cut off some of the non-trivial infrared dynamics. But the most interesting things will happen when we don't cut it off, okay? Or when we cut it off only with the twisted mass term. So let's try and describe the Coulomb branch of the theory. By the Coulomb branch, I mean the situation in which there is some unbroken abelian gauge symmetry. So the charged, we don't want the charged scalars to get expectation values. The charged chiral multiplets to get expectation values. We want to see what happens when we do not cut off the strong gauge dynamics with a VEV. So we consider the low energy effective theory obtained by integrating out the massive matter fields. And so that's where the twisted mass comes in. It makes these massive matter fields, it makes this integrating out process non-singular, right? So we give all of these chiral multiplets masses with the twisted mass term, which I'll construct a bit more, and we obtain some twisted superpotential, some potential for the scalar in the gauge multiplet, capital sigma, whose lowest component is lowercase sigma. Now, if you took off this exponential, so if we just said that this thing inside the exponential was zero, that would be the standard vacuum equation. The fact that we get this deformation of it, which gives you more vacua, that has to do with subtle effects involving flux and finite volume. I don't want to go into that right now because it's quite subtle, but it's been addressed to some extent in the recent work of Nekrasov and Witten. But there's certainly more to be said about it. But let me not go into it right now. But you can see here that it's a generalization of the standard vacuum equation. It gives you the standard vacua corresponding to the critical points of the twisted superpotential and more. Now the point is this twisted superpotential can be computed exactly. It's one loop exact, and just comes from a determinant from integrating out the fields with twisted masses. Right. So, in the absence of a superpotential, so let's not add a superpotential just at the moment, though I will talk about consistency conditions for superpotentials, actually quite simple. The action is just quadratic in the matter fields. So, just by Feynman diagrams alone, even without any supersymmetry magic, you can see that the action is the effective action from integrating out X is purely one loop. So what does it actually look like? So the effective twisted superpotential for each fundamental field, so for each chiral multiplet in the fundamental, one receives this sigma log sigma contribution to the twisted superpotential. For anti-fundamentals, we get something that looks roughly the same with a sign difference. And then for adjoints, we get an interesting thing which depends only on the differences of eigenvalues of the sigma field. So in general, when we have a non-abelian symmetry, sigma is a matrix, and then sigma I and sigma j are the eigenvalues of that matrix. Okay. Questions so far?
So what does the potential look like after the effective points, right? Sigma
That's an interesting question. I don't know the answer to that. But it would be good. I mean, I would guess that fact probably has a natural interpretation in the spin chain language. Though I can't in real time, I'm not sure how to interpret it. So the case, so the simplest case considered by Shevchenko and Nekrasov would be a UN two-dimensional gauge theory with L flavors, L hypermultiplets, fundamental and anti-fundamental hypermultiplets. So using the rules above, we find some twisted chiral superpotential that's a sum of sigma log sigma terms. where the final contribution doesn't have an L in front, the others do. And the vacua look like this. So now this is just rewriting the vacuum equations corresponding to the one loop effective superpotential that's generated by integrating out the matter representations. To someone like me who has never worked on integrable models or spin chains or anything, it doesn't mean much. But I think to people who have worked on this subject, this really jumps out immediately. It rings a lot of bells as something that looks exactly like the beta ansatz for a some integrable system. Yes. It has to do with the fact that the matter fields enter exactly quadratically into the action. So in terms of Feynman diagrams, I can write it on the board, but it wouldn't be too visible. But in terms of Feynman diagrams, picture the matter fields as black lines, and picture the gauge multiplet as wavy lines or something. There are no vertices with other than two black lines, right? So it's impossible to make a Feynman diagram with more than a connected Feynman diagram by integrating out only the black lines, which has more than one loop, right? Well, yeah, the non-perturbative thing to say is that it's a determinant calculation, but that's just translating that Feynman diagrammatic statement into field theoretic rather than diagrammatic language. There's an explicit determinant one can do, right? It's like the Euler-Heisenberg effect of action, except that the difference is once you've generated this twisted chiral superpotential, there are no perturbative interactions that can renormalize it, and I think I understand what you're saying. You're saying you integrate out the matter representations, you generate a twisted chiral superpotential, and then the self interactions of the gauge multiplet you're worried about whether they non-perturbatively renormalize the. With alpha primes on them or without? With alpha primes on them or without? I mean, geometric engineering, I'll remind people, is not a decoupled construction. It's geometric engineering doesn't have a simple decoupling limit, or in general a known decoupling limit. So there are alpha prime corrections to everything, and this fact about the matter representations entering only quadratically isn't true in a non-normalizable correction to it. So it may be an artifact of the addition of alpha prime corrections. But I think it's a good question after you've integrated out, in the decoupled theory, after you've integrated out the matter representations at one loop, what is the argument that self-interactions of the gauge stuff that's left over can't give further corrections. I don't offhand have a simple answer to that. I suspect that there is a relatively simple answer, but I don't know it offhand. But in integrability, people will recognize this as the same equation describing the beta ansatz for the XXX spin chain with a particular ratio if we take a particular ratio of the mass of the fundamental to the mass of the adjoint. Okay. Let that squiggle just be a number. This is actually true for any complex number, because let's actually take the squiggle to be a real number. It's a convention whether you call it purely real or purely imaginary. I will explain quite soon what this imaginary mass is and how you what this real mass is and how you think of it. Yeah, but it's well, the sigma like sigma. Oh, right. So, well, how you write the constant term, you're thinking about the thing where you shift the x's. Yeah. I mean, there's a symmetry, just of the gauge theory, Lagrangian, in which one shifts the, sigma field just by shifting the sigma field by something proportional to the identity, and also redefines the twisted masses. This is just because of, that's not what you're asking about. So, can you be more specific about what's the but the
in place of 1, I mean, you just want to say minus 1.
Oh, I understand. I see what you're saying. Okay, so since it's cutoff dependent, it must be a counter term you could add to the original action. Right. So let me think. Right. I understand, but I understand the question. I'm just trying to let's see. So it is something that should be absorbable into. I mean, Thank you. Yes, that's right. So since, right, you can see it can be absorbed. Yes, it can be absorbed into a redefinition of the FI term. Thank you, that's the right answer. Good. Very good. Thank you. Yes, sigma will be real. The solutions are all real. Assuming that M is real. With this convention, yes, with this convention, assuming that M is imaginary. Thank you. What's the question? Wait, sorry, but if M is taken to be pure imaginary, the vacuum solutions are not all. Okay. My mistake. Thank you for the question, though. I want to emphasize some of the kind of surprising and even shocking aspects of the gauge beta correspondence, because we're familiar with a lot of dualities and stuff in string theory. We've almost stopped being surprised when one system is described as just another familiar system in disguise. you know, many people, maybe even some of you may feel, well, same old, same old. Why should we be so interested in yet another stunningly non-trivial equivalence between quantum theories? But this type of correspondence is really very different than things that we're used to. And let me explain why. So the Hilbert space for a spin chain decomposes into Magnon sectors, really meaning just the number of spins up minus the number of spins down. Okay, and that's just nothing surprising about that. But it's a chopping up of the Hilbert space that's fundamentally non-local. Okay, a state with a spin up over here and a spin down 10 to the 500 sites away is in the same sector as a state with no spins up. So it's a way of chopping up the Hilbert space, but those particular Magnon sectors correspond to different gauge theories. So the number of spins up determines the rank of the gauge theory to which the particular sector of the spin chain Hilbert space corresponds under the gauge beta correspondence. That's actually a little bit weird. You should certainly think it's a little bit weird. Dualities in string theory do not in general, dualities that we're familiar with don't work that way. Then there's a second weirdness having to do with the fact that the full Hilbert space of the spin chain corresponds only to the vacuum sectors of the gauge theories. Now that's a little bit more familiar to modern people because there are other correspondences in our field like the AGT correspondence, which is a correspondence between the full Hilbert space of a Liouville theory and just the BPS sector of a four-dimensional gauge theory. But it's still generally not how these types of dualities work. So the spin chain is both bigger and smaller than any given gauge theory. And we'd like to develop a kind of more robust way of thinking about this correspondence. And the idea is that embedding in string theory should help us to do that. So the thing we want to focus on is really the first of these. And really, we're not going to have anything to say about the second at the moment. But hopefully, we can set up a framework to say something constructive about the second. But at the moment, we're just going to set up a framework in string theory to help us understand what this strange correspondence between specific subsectors of one theory and different gauge theories, on the other hand, can possibly mean, where it can possibly come from. And just for people who are familiar with both sides, this is the specific dictionary between gauge theory quantities and spin chain quantities. And as somebody who has never worked on spin chains, I essentially don't know what any of the things in the second column actually are. But my collaborators do. Okay. I mean, I know it a little bit, but not too much, unfortunately.
Can I ask you?
Ooh, God, that's such a good question. I personally don't know orthogonal or simplex analogs. But I think that this has been thought about and can be constructed. I mean, let me also say that when we get towards the end, and you see the string theory embedding, it'll give a recipe for constructing orthogonal and symplectic analogs as well. Because in the end, we'll turn everything into a D-brain construction, and we know in principle how to add orientifold planes to D-brains to get orthogonal and symplectic groups. So if I haven't answered more specifically by the end, please do ask again. It does make sense. I mean, large N limits are things that we... It's not just in this limit. That's the interesting thing. So this new hidden symmetry is there for all L and all N. It's only precisely there in the infinite coupling limit in the two-dimensional theory. And again, we'll be able to see why that is. Okay. String theory gives a very simple explanation for that. Okay, so here is the explanation. Okay, so how do we obtain these two-dimensional theories? What's the simplest way? Well, we're gonna really think in terms of three-dimensional theories compactified on an interval. That's the simplest way to obtain a two-dimensional gauge theory with the amount of supersymmetry that we want. Is to take a three-dimensional gauge theory and compactify on an interval. So just at the Lagrangian level, these two-dimensional theories can be obtained that way. That was discussed in Nekrasov and Chatishvili. But there's a very natural way of doing that in string theory that has properties that are going to be helpful to us. How do we... thanks. So for a moment, just forget about all of these other brains and just look at these D2 brains. We can start out with a 16 supercharge gauge theory, right? So there's a unique gauge theory in three dimensions with 16 supercharges, or a unique normalizable gauge theory with 16 supercharges in three dimensions. And it's obtained by just taking the low energy limit of string theory in the presence of n D2 brains. Okay, and then there are three things we want to do to this gauge theory to get exactly the gauge theory of Nekrasov and Chatishvili. One is to compactify on an interval. We do that by adding two NS5 brains and having the D2 brains end on them. The second thing we want to do is to add hypermultiplets in the fundamental and anti-fundamental representation. We can do that by adding D4 brains, which intersect the D2 brains in a particular way. And that particular way is specified by this dimensional diagram here. So the X's are the dimensions along which the brains are extended. And the third thing we want to do, which is not pictured here, is to add these twisted mass terms. So we're not doing this in this diagram, but the simple part of this construction can all be understood with this simple set of brains and without the deformation. And there are various things that can be understood simply in this language. But the most important thing that can be understood in this language or in this construction is the enhanced symmetry. Okay, so let me just skip to this bit so you can see where the enhanced symmetry comes from. So we have D2 brains suspended between two parallel NS5s. Now, there's a particular conceptual reason why it's very difficult and perhaps even impossible in principle to establish this correspondence with an uncompactified D2 brain. So the reason is that one should never superpose states in string theory or quantum field theory that have different VEVs, that have different boundary conditions at spatial infinity. The principle of cluster decomposition says you're never supposed to do that. Okay. But at the same time, the corresponding states in the spin chain all do live in the same Hilbert space. They can be superposed and mixed and so forth. So that tells you that we really ought to compactify the spatial direction of this 1+1 dimensional gauge theory in order to understand the correspondence. So we're going to do that. But then once we compactify, we have a very simple picture. As soon as we compactify the D2 brains along their non-compact spatial dimension, we obtain something which has an enhanced gauge symmetry that lives on the NS5 brains. So there is, by the way, a funny, very, very funny symmetry that lives on these NS5 brains even prior to compactification, but it's a symmetry that really nobody understands. It's a two-form gauge symmetry that is still completely not understood, despite really years of study. But as soon as one compactifies with an arbitrarily large radius, that two-form gauge symmetry turns into an ordinary gauge symmetry, a non-abelian gauge symmetry, in this case an SU2 gauge symmetry, living on the two NS5 brains, that is broken only spontaneously by the separation of of the two NS5s. So what does that symmetry look like? Well, there are various ways of understanding it, and the simplest way of understanding it is through duality. So if one first compactifies the x1 direction much smaller than string scale, one can turn the d2s into d1s. And then after s-duality, one can turn the NS5s into d5s. And then the non-abelian symmetry is quite manifest. And it just has to do with the gauge symmetry living on the D5 brains. And by the way, this whole construction generalizes to the full set of general SUN times SUN, etc. quiver theories studied by Nekrasov and Chazhvili. One simply takes multiple clumps of NS5 brains with arbitrary numbers of D2 brains suspended between them. And in that construction, one always obtains the correct enhanced non-abelian symmetry from this duality to a D-brain system. But remember, when you T-dual an NS5 longitudinally, as opposed to transversely, it doesn't lose a dimension. It just turns into another NS5. Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. So in the dual type 2B picture, you have two NS5s supporting an SU2 gauge symmetry. Okay. It's an exotic SU2 gauge symmetry whose gauge bosons are finite D1 brains stretching between the two NS5s, but nonetheless, it's a gauge symmetry. And it can be understood at the Lagrangian or quasi-Lagrangian level by S-duality to a D5 system. Okay. So just for brevity, we'll call this the first, second, and third picture of the enhanced symmetry in the Nekrasov-Chazhvili correspondence. And the thing I would emphasize is that this is at least in the case of quivers whose gauge groups are SUN, this generalizes fully and is a full explanation for the enhanced non-abelian symmetry in the Nekrasov-Chazhvili correspondence. So this is now a solved problem. Except you could criticize that, hey, the Nekrasov-Chazhvili correspondence doesn't make sense in the absence of twisted masses. So that is the fly in the ointment in terms of everything I've told you so far. That's the fatal flaw, or not fatal. I'm going to tell you it's not fatal, but that's the incompleteness in terms of what I've said so far. Okay. So the remaining bit that I'll tell you about is how this twisted mass deformation is constructed, and how it essentially doesn't interfere with all the rest of this structure, given some plausible assumptions. Right, but the point is that the correspondence is really only defined for non-zero twisted masses. Otherwise, the sigmas all go off to infinity, and there isn't a regular vacuum structure. You get runaways instead of well-defined vacua. It's supposed to make one aspect of the correspondence obvious, which is to say that. Sorry? Two-dimensional, okay, yeah. Right, no, I, I'm not claiming at all that this makes manifest the full correspondence. The one thing it makes manifest is a chunk of the correspondence which may be helpful for unraveling the whole thing. This gives you the enhanced symmetry without seeing the spin chain. So I think the strategy in the spin chain the enhanced. Because the symmetry on the spin chain side is manifest, just at the Lagrangian level. Previously, on the gauge theory side, it's utterly obscure. So the idea is that if one can make manifest the full symmetry, let's say one could make manifest the. Yeah. This construction makes. But I want to emphasize the symmetry that it makes manifest is not the gauge symmetry living at the Lagrangian level in the two-dimensional gauge theory. It's the non-Lagrangian symmetry. I should write the full set of symmetries on the board. Okay. So what are the symmetries? So what are the symmetries at issue here? So there's an SUN. I'm not even going to talk about the SUL. Never mind about that. And then there's an SU2. Spin chain, gauge theory, string theory. Okay, so the SUN on the spin chain side is just non-existent. There's no such thing. And it shouldn't exist because it's a gauge symmetry. It's confined. It doesn't act on states. In the gauge theory, it's a gauge symmetry. And it's manifest at weak coupling. In the string theory, it's also manifest. The SU2 is a global symmetry. It's global and manifest at the Lagrangian level. And it really just rotates the spins. In the gauge theory, it's present, but completely non-manifest. It's analogous to think of it as being like the E6 that lives in the trinium theory for n equals 3. That's the analogy. It's a quantum mechanical global symmetry that's present, but it's difficult to see. It's invisible. Present at strong coupling. Present at infinite coupling. And it's global as a symmetry in two dimensions. And then in string theory, the same is true. Present at infinite coupling, global, but non-manifest. But the SU2 over here is present at infinite coupling. It's global in two dimensions, but fantastically, it's manifest in the string construction. That's the SU2 of the two parallel NS5 brains. That's right. And I mean, I think probably you would like to think of it better after T-dualing transversely to the NS5s. Then, I mean, this is the duality that you invented with Harvey and Gregory. Where the NS5s are turned into an A1 singularity. Okay, so there that symmetry becomes the global symmetry living on the six-dimensional gauge symmetry living on the A1 singularity, or the six-dimensional gauge theory living on the NS5s. But then after this this other pair of dualities, it just turns into an SU2 living on the living on two 5 grains. Does that okay? Yeah, a question.
Last sign in front of this Hamiltonian of sigma for the infinite chain, this is U2 that extended to infinite dimensional quantum group, which was invented by Greenfield called Yang-Yang.
Yes.
Have any traces from the string sign?
Absolutely. What I mean is that's an absolutely good question. It doesn't mean the answer is absolutely yes. This is the second half of the answer to Greg's question, which is why are you telling me about this? So the answer is that the zero mode piece of this Yangian algebra is just this global symmetry, right? So identifying this global symmetry on both sides is the first step to identifying the full Yangian symmetry. But states in this theory are completely characterized by the representations under the Yangian symmetry. So if one understands how the full Yangian symmetry maps, one has a full one-to-one correspondence established. And so one can just reconstruct the spin chain, all the spin chain quantities completely. Okay. L. So L is the number of hypermultiplets. And the hypermultiplets are these D4 brains, which I haven't been talking much about. If are there any more questions about all this structure? Not in an obvious. So the question was whether you can think of the spin chain as being what again? No. I mean the magnons are the. Are the ground state, every state, remember, every state in the spin chain is a vacuum state of this whole brain configuration. So, there's a real question, which, I'm just checking how much time I actually have left. Not that much. I would like to talk to anyone who would like to hear about it, about what I think is the key question, which is what do non-vacuum states in these gauge theories correspond to in the spin chain language? That is not the same as asking as what state in the Hilbert space of the spin chain do they correspond to, because the answer is none. Every state in the Hilbert space of the spin chain corresponds to a vacuum state in the gauge theory. But nonetheless, it's likely, we believe, that non-vacuum states in the gauge theories have some interpretation in the spin chain language. Yeah. No, the number of sites, or the number of magnons is the number. Oh, so you mean in the third picture? Yeah, excuse me, I think I misunderstood your question. I don't want to say the number of, let me say why I don't quite want to say that the answer is yes. The reason I don't quite want to say that the answer is yes is that all of the vacuum states correspond to one particle states in this language, so that they're bound states. They don't really look like two fundamental strings. They still look like they have the quantum numbers of two fundamental strings stretching between those brains, but it's more in the nature of a bound state. Okay. Yeah, okay, thanks. Okay, so right, the point is just that this whole structure with the enhanced symmetry and hopefully the first bite at the identification of the full correspondence all has to do is all visible without the addition of the twisted masses. The twisted masses really you can just think of as a kind of a regulator that preserves all of the supersymmetry and the other symmetries that you'd like, but none. So it's just in some sense a technical point, but it's a technical point that ought to be addressed. And we addressed it, and in the remaining 10? 5.
No.
10, okay. 10 plus. In the remaining 10 plus minutes, I'll just explain this this deformation that gives rise to the twisted masses, and how one rediscovers an interesting connection with the omega background in this correspondence. Okay, so. So a fundamental but non-standard ingredient is given by the twisted masses. And you know, this whole structure with the twisted masses is really orthogonal to the case of orthogonal to the addition of the NS5 brains and the D4 brains. So those things are really irrelevant to the twisted mass deformation. So to understand it, it's convenient to lift the two-dimensional theory to three dimensions, in which case the twisted masses become what's known as real masses. The real mass, a real mass is a real parameter by which a three-dimensional Suzy gauge theory can be deformed, and it descends to this thing called twisted masses upon dimensional reduction on a circle or interval. Then it's useful to lift again to four dimensions, in which case the real masses correspond to Wilson line boundary conditions for the compactification, by which I mean Wilson line for a global symmetry of the four-dimensional gauge theory, okay, not a gauge symmetry. Now these boundary conditions, and then once one has identified this boundary condition for compactification of the four-dimensional gauge theory, the boundary condition lifts in a simple way to string theory, and one can very simply construct the string version of this twisted mass deformation, and this deformation of the string theory has a very long history that goes back to the 1950s, starting with the work of Melvin, and then developed much later by in the 21st century by Strominger, Gutperl, Takayanagi, and others under the name of flux brains, and sort of in parallel by Nekrasov and others under the name of the omega deformation. Just to give a quick cartoon of this construction, so one takes the three-dimensional real mass, which is a deformation that I'll describe of the three-dimensional gauge theory, dimensionally oxidizes to a four-dimensional gauge theory without a Lagrangian deformation, but with deformed boundary conditions. And then both of these have, this has a simple lift to string theory. So the D3 brain in a Melvin background or flux brain background, omega background, whatever you'd like to call it, they're all names for the exact same thing. And then one can dimensionally reverse the dimensional oxidation, go back down to three dimensions in the gauge theory, which corresponds to a T-duality in the string theory. And then one can do the T-duality of this flux brain solution explicitly, and one finds a closed string background such that placing the D2 brains in it gives a real mass deformation of the D2 brain. Okay, so that's the cartoon, or the quick summary. First, let me talk real quick about the. I think I didn't send you the most recent version. That's okay. I'll just. Is it okay if I write on the blackboard again? I'm sorry, David. So how do you think about the twisted mass or the real mass? So here is a universal, superspace-free, and a general construction of twisted mass deformations of gauge theories with four or more supercharges. So in three dimensions, one starts with a n equals 2 theory with global symmetries. G, so a billion global symmetries, let's say. So for any global symmetry generators, one can choose real parameters with mass dimension 1, m sub I, such that one can take a deformation so as to add a central term. So with a central term, such that the deformed Susi algebra looks like Q alpha Q bar beta equals 2 gamma mu P mu alpha beta plus 2z delta alpha beta, where z is just m sub I g upper I. And for any non for any non-R global symmetries, one can algorithmically construct such a deformation. Okay, such that the deformed theory is still supersymmetric and has this central term. Okay. And then states which carry these charges, so states carrying G sub I get masses. Just given by absolute value of m sub I q upper I, where these q upper i's are the eigenvalues of the global symmetry generators g upper I. Okay. And these states are BPS. So in general, there's a more general formula. Plus m f plus d squared. So in general, there are two contributions to the mass, one of which is the mass coming from the f and d term potentials, and the other of which is this this mass just given by the eigenvalue of z. But if the state was massless prior to the deformation, one gets a BPS state whose mass is exactly given by the mass parameters in the Lagrangian and by the charges under G. Right. So there are many ways to think about this, but the simplest is in cases where the three-dimensional theory lifts. So if the three-dimensional theory lifts to four dimensions, then one can dimensionally oxidize, which don't seem to be comprehensible in any clear way, by just thinking about the massless degrees of freedom, which would show up in the topological string. Okay, these massive W bosons, which generate this non-trivial hidden symmetry at finite coupling, they're not massless degrees of freedom. There are real states carrying real charges. These mass terms and their BPS properties are things that all exist above the level of massless fluctuations. There's some structure here, this extended symmetry, which seems to be exact in the physical string. Right. Should organize not just the vacuum states or even the BPS states, but should organize the full spectrum of the string theory at strong coupling. This is telling us something really non-trivial, not just about chiral rings or about BPS properties, but it is telling us something really non-trivial about the strong coupling behavior of two-dimensional gauge theories, that this Nekrasov-Shadashvili correspondence may just be scratching the surface of. So I think I'd like to end my talk there and take questions.